This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and Nirvana's song Smells Like Teen Spirit is, in more ways than one, an appropriate way to lead into our next conversation. The writer Hua Su was born in Champaign, Urbana, the child of two Taiwanese immigrants. From there, his family moved to Texas and then California. His father eventually moved back to Taiwan to take a job as a business executive. Hua eventually went to college at the University of California, Berkeley, and earned a PhD from Harvard. His new book is Stay True, a memoir. In it, he describes his experiences as a second-generation Taiwanese-American coming of age in the 90s. And in many ways, the book is a postcard from an era that's increasingly hard to remember, when people could go for long stretches without being photographed, and where, as Hu puts it, there was a precariousness to out-of-the-way knowledge. Let's listen to a brief excerpt from the audiobook version of Stay True.
At that age, time moves slow. You're eager for something to happen, passing time in parking lots, hands deep in your pockets, trying to figure out where to go next. Life happened elsewhere. It was simply a matter of finding a map that led there. Or maybe, at that age, time moves fast. You're so desperate for action that you forget to remember things as they happen. A day felt like forever. A year was a geological era.
Hua Su is a professor of English at Bard College in New York. He's also a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he joins us now. Hua, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So there's so much to get into, but I want to start with the beginning. You were born in Champaign, Urbana. You did move to Texas in your youth, but what do you remember of Illinois?
You know, I remember absolutely nothing. I've always had this affinity for Illinois and Chicago, but I had no idea. You know, all I knew as a kid was I grew up, that I was born in Champaign-Urbana. I had no idea what the distance was to Chicago, but as a kid, I think just as an affectation, I adopted Chicago as my birthplace. I understand it's not remotely close. But, you know, I rooted for the Cubs, all sorts of things. My only knowledge of Champaign-Urbana came from, like, the University of Illinois stuff that my parents had around.
Yeah, that's great. As somebody who grew up in the Chicago suburbs and has been chastised for saying I'm from Chicago, we can talk about that another time. But, okay, I mentioned at the beginning of this segment, your parents were Taiwanese immigrants. What did the idea of America mean to them? What drew them here?
You know, I'm not sure they had a very formed idea of America, if they had any real idea at all. They grew up in Taiwan at a time when it was still very much kind of recovering from World War II, recovering from kind of colonization of the past. So for them, coming to the United States in the 60s and 70s just represented opportunity. It wasn't necessarily a fixed or even legible dream. It was just sort of a place to further your education. They didn't necessarily have any sense of what it was they were getting themselves into, although they were familiar with, you know, like the music and the movies and things like that. It was just sort of a place to further their education.
Yeah, and it was a time of such higher levels of immigration that, and you yeah. write about this idea in the book of this concept of the term Asian American. We interviewed Kevin Pang last year, who wrote this book, an entire book on this subject.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea that that identity didn't necessarily make sense for your parents to adopt. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And you know, what's interesting is I grew up primarily in the Silicon Valley, and there was this oddly disproportionate number of people I went to school with who were also born in Champaign-Urbana. There were just a lot of schools like the University of Illinois, Purdue, different sort of Midwestern engineering programs that were recruiting and just really creating opportunities for students from Taiwan. And so a lot of people like my parents ended up in the Midwest and then eventually moved to places like California or New York. And for them, you know, they were very proximate to the social movements happening. My parents participated in quite a few themselves, but they had no real connection per se with the sort of latter generation folks who were coming up with concepts like Asian American in the late 60s. These were often students who were from New York or California whose families had been here for generations and who probably had more articulated senses of what they wanted to do and be in America than people who were first generation immigrants like my parents.
And they had a sort of an ambivalent relationship with the idea of assimilating, right? Like you talk about your dad sort of really growing to love American music, and then he kind of maybe backs away from that a little bit later on. I don't know if you can talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they necessarily arrived with any, you know, vision of whether they would stay or not. You know, it's just sort of like, we're going to get the degree and kind of see what happens. But they did learn to really, you know, love a lot of aspects of being Americans. You know, my parents were really into music, which is something that I eventually inherited after a bit of kind of my own snobbery, just this idea of the freedom and the opportunity and the liberation of American rock and roll. It's something that they were really drawn to. But yeah, ultimately, I think my dad moved back to Taiwan to work in the 1980s, and he just acquired a much more like flexible version of what it meant to be American. It meant that you could be here, you could be there, but it was sort of this idea that accompanied him from across the ocean.
I love the way you describe his musical taste too in the book about, right, he had the Beatles and Lennon and Harrison's solo albums,
yeah,
but not McCartney's, which you took to mean something. How did your own upbringing, I mean, you started out in Champaign-Urbana, so you don't have much memory of that. Then you were in Texas. You write about wanting to get cowboy boots, so it must have been, yeah, for a good spell there. Then you're in California. What was that like, jumping around so many different parts of the U.S.?
You know, when you're a kid, you're just sort of bundled along with your parents wherever they go. So I didn't really have any sense of where we were. You know, like I had no idea how the culture of Texas differed from the culture of California. You know, when you're a kid, you're just concerned about, like, is there a Target here? Is there a Toys R Us here? I do remember that my parents were just always bringing their records with them everywhere they went. And that was kind of a part of the household identity that I took for granted until I realized that not everyone's parents were kind of this into music. But, you know, they were the first experts that I consulted. So like you said, there are certain gaps in their collection. And I took this to mean that, like, the Beach Boys were terrible or Paul McCartney's solo albums were terrible, which are not actually true. But it was just that our worlds were so small then. And moving from Texas, Illinois, California, you know, we brought those tastes and preferences with us.
You know, some kids rebel against what their parents like. And here you are talking about Guns N' Roses with your father. Why do you think music came to mean something for you? And how did that help you sort of discover yourself as you were coming of age?
You know, I did rebel slightly in the sense that, like, because my parents were so into music, I thought that music was just what boring adults did. So, you know, my dad would take me to Tower Records, this, you know, chain record store, after dinner, and I would just be pretty bored. Although now I look back and, you know, like, I wish I could do stuff like that. Eventually, I think just the idea that your tastes matter once you get to middle school, once you get to high school. And I realized that having parents who had such kind of unique tastes, at least among kind of Asian American immigrants, you know, it was sort of like this cool bank of knowledge that I could consult. So yeah, it was great to kind of replicate what they were doing and sort of already be familiar with, you know, the science of making a mixtape or figuring out, like, where to get records and things like that. It was something that I'm glad I appreciated before it was too late.
I think you and I are roughly the same age, and I mean, we could probably both sing the guitar solo from November Rain still if we had
yeah.
to. But I like how you talk about
searing.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly it, because you talk about your dad sort of appreciating it as a virtuoso piece of musicianship, whereas
yeah.
you're hearing it on an emotional level. Maybe you can talk about that disconnect.
Yeah, and you know, Guns N' Roses, I mean, I have no idea. I think any listener who's probably in their 40s or above kind of can appreciate that Guns N' Roses once seemed to be like this incredibly transgressive rock band. And they're a band that my dad was into, but I wasn't that into music. And so I sort of dismissed them as just something that adults liked. And, you know, my dad always, he's always liked kind of those kind of pyrotechnic guitar solos. But whereas I would hear that stuff as evidence of, you know, this is true liberation, this is someone really going somewhere else, you know, I think it sort of conformed to their sense of like, oh, no, this is the work. This is evidence of someone's practice, right? This is like someone mastering their skill. And in the book, I sort of read that as, you know, the first generation is really concerned just with survival and with like acquiring these skills and sort of like legible skills. And then the second generation, someone like me, can be, you know, a little bit more of a dreamer, a little bit more unsettled and romantic about these things.
Right. And you talk about them wanting you to get that sort of, what is it, STEM training, right? Science, technology, engineering, and math. Math, not your strong suit, you say. And you yeah. turned more to letters, or that's a highfalutin way to say it, but writing, right? So talk about that and how that helped you find a sense of who you were as a person in those early years.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty, it's an almost generic story, I would say, among a lot of Asian Americans, particularly folks of my generation or people who are second generation or 1.5. I think across the board, not just among Asians, immigrants tend to gravitate toward these fields like math and science, where, you know, you can't really discriminate against answers. Like, as long as you do the work, it feels somewhat more meritocratic and thus safer and more stable. And my parents, like many Asian American parents, kind of pushed me towards those. But I was quite bad at these things. And I really preferred writing. And I was making my own zines and doing all sorts of things that people did in the 1990s. And I thought that was that seemed a path to stability for me that math could never provide, because I was just so awful at it.
You write about sort of a seminal moment in your, I guess, high school years, I'm guessing. I personally was on a marching band trip to Florida when I learned that Kurt Cobain had taken his own life.
Yes.
I wonder if you can talk about that experience for you and your peers.
You know, it's interesting. I think all 13, 14, 15-year-olds, like you feel like you have this singular grasp of the things you love. And that was certainly the case for me. I mean, I really loved Nirvana, but then again, so did, you know, 40 million other people at that time. And I remember,
it was just the two of us.
Yeah. but you know, I think what's unique is like what you do with that, like how you take that passion, through the rest of your life, and sort of like how you try and see through on it, even if you're no longer listening to them as much. But I remember, yeah, I was in high school, I was in journalism class. First we heard a rumor that he had passed away, like months before he actually passed away. And so we'd all kind of cycled through these different stages of grief, such that when it actually happened, you know, I think like a lot of people at our school had already kind of experienced it, because we had sort of heard this false rumor months earlier. But I just started writing articles, and I think for the school paper, I wrote my dad about it, because we would fax back and forth. And I think I was like almost too good of a writer, because my dad became very concerned that I was like incredibly depressed as a result. But in reality, I was just trying to figure out how I felt, and writing was the way to do it. Writing was the way to figure out like what aspects of this mass moment of teenage grieving I identified with, and what parts like I couldn't quite wrap my head around.
Yeah, the faxes you include in the book back and forth, he seemed really supportive and engaged. It's really quite touching. I want to come back to something you said a moment ago, which is taking a passion like Nirvana's my favorite band and seeing how that runs through the rest of your life. Can you say more about that? How has Nirvana run through your fandom, run through the rest of your life and work?
That's a good question. You know, I'm 45 years old, which means I was 13 when Smells Like Teen Spirit, the song you played at the top of the segment, came out. And, you know, like I said, it's like kind of generic to have been into Nirvana. And yet each of us experienced that moment in our own way, you know, and each of us, you know, maybe some people disavowed them later. Maybe some people got into everything they did following. But I think in that moment of discovery, these worlds open up, you know, and it's not just with them, it's sort of with any great art. I think how we're moved by it, the new possibilities we see, the new horizons we see. For me personally, I mean, this was a moment where I felt like I had discovered something on my own for the first time ever. And that was really intoxicating. Like, it made me super interested in like obscure music or histories that I felt had been denied to us, or these broken lineages and failed revolutions. And I think that that was something that I continued to be really drawn to, even today as an academic, as a writer. I think I'm still drawn to those questions of like, what if this had actually been popular? What if this person had been able to see through on their impossible vision? But of course, also part of the Nirvana story is that conflict that the singer Kurt Cobain seemed to feel about being famous, about the fact that he was no longer this sort of obscure, overlooked punk rocker, and the responsibility, the pressure he felt, or so they say, around being this spokesperson. And I think that's something that my generation, insofar as that term makes any sense, gravitated towards. This is idea that you could be like really famous, but really ambivalent and almost troubled by your own fame. It was sort of a new pose that not a lot of us had really seen before.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guest. This is the 21st show. We're speaking with Hua Su, who is the author of the new memoir called Stay True. He's also a staff writer at The New Yorker and a professor of English at Bard College. The book recounts his coming of age as a child of Taiwanese immigrants, and also a searing experience he had at college with one of his best friends. And we're going to talk more about that when we come back. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with Hua Su, who is the author of the memoir Stay True. He's also a staff writer at The New Yorker and a professor of English at Bard College. If you want to join our conversation, the number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Well, we began our conversation talking about your coming of age, the child of immigrants from Taiwan. We talked about how your father actually moved back to Taiwan to take a job. The second part of the book really focuses on your friendship with a college buddy named Ken. Tell us more. Who was Ken? What was he to you?
You know, I think a lot of us go to college to find our people, you know, find our tribe. And as was probably evident, as clear by the first part of our conversation, by the time I arrived at college, I had a pretty clear sense of what I thought was cool and uncool. Like, I was very particular about the things I liked. This was the 90s after all, and I think I was very drawn to certain forms of like alternative or independent culture. And Ken was a friend I made in our first year dorms. We were pretty different in many regards. Like, I was wearing thrifted clothes and making zines and going to kind of like underground shows. And he was in a fraternity and he was much more confident. And he was just much more confident and open than I was. And initially that really turned me off. But I learned quite a bit being his friend, and just kind of being around his openness and kindness changed me. And it really changed the way I understood, not necessarily just what it meant to be cool or what it meant to be cool with yourself, but also what it means to be a friend and a good friend.
And a significant part of the book deals with, and this is going to seem like a sudden turn for our listeners, but Ken is murdered, and in the aftermath of that, and I'm guessing it's been, what, about a quarter century for you? In just reading about it in your book, I feel like I should begin by offering my condolences. So the to the extent you're comfortable going back there, what was it like for you in those first days after you found out that, that Ken had been killed?
Sure. So, you know, when I was 21 when it happened, this is 1998, we'd been friends for 3 years, and, you know, we had a really great group of friends together. And I think over time, I'd really just kind of lightened up about how seriously I took the things that I was into as a result of being friends with him. Like, we would always just smoke cigarettes on balconies and have these kind of long debates about life and our dreams, things like that. And the night he was killed was actually this party he threw, like a housewarming party. And we were in the middle of this conversation, you know, kind of ritualistically smoking our cigarettes, talking. And I had to go somewhere else. And I didn't realize that it was the last time I would see him. Later that night, he would be abducted in the garage of his apartment. And yeah, for reasons that were never quite fully explained, even the perpetrators never could explain why it had gone the way it did. But his carjackers killed him that night. And in those hours, days immediately afterwards, I found a lot of I don't want to say solace or peace, because I don't think I felt it necessarily, but I just started writing quite obsessively. It was just sort of a place to go. And so in some ways, I've been writing this memoir that we've been talking about for ever since then, so for about 20 some years.
How has Ken stayed with you? I mean, you talked about you've been writing this book for 20 years. How has his memory lived on for you?
You know, it's a little similar to what we're talking about with Nirvana just before the break, and how, you know, everyone had an experience with this band, but it's really like what you take with you as you move on from that moment of discovery. You know, Ken was this great person who touched so many lives. I mean, he was just sort of almost like sort of this impossibly kind and open-hearted person, you know, someone who could be as at ease with his frat brothers or at a party as he was with me talking about, you know, my weird thrift store clothes and my zines and the music I was into. He was just very open to the world, and he dreamed. He had sort of like much larger dreams than I did, because I think I was the type of person who, out of fear of disappointment, would just not expect anything or just sort of stand sarcastically in the corner instead of actually opening myself up to anything. And so, you know, over the past couple decades, I've actually kind of become a writer, the writer that I never thought I would become. I've become a journalist. I've become an academic. And at each turn, I'm sort of constantly thinking about that moment and sort of how so many things were set in motion for me in terms of being a writer, wanting to write this thing, but not knowing what it was, wanting to understand his influence on me, but not quite having the language for it. It's been a pursuit that's just kind of been in the background of all my work since that night.
In the acknowledgments of the book, you mentioned that you didn't really, I don't know, how would I say, understand that this was a book until your agent saw it as one. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I clearly saw it as a book because I brought it to my agent. But over that period of time, you know, when I was 21, 22, into my 30s, it was just sort of a thing that I was working on. Like, I didn't know that it would someday take the form of a book, because for so many years it was just a sort of like miscellaneous mess of emotions and scenes and just things that I wanted to capture. In the immediate aftermath, I just started cataloging. And, you know, I think anyone who goes through loss, you know, you're really stung by the fact that the other person in a story will no longer be there to remember it with you, you know, or the other holder of this inside joke is no longer around. And even though these seem like pretty banal things in the grand scheme of things, like they become very important because you no longer have the capacity to create new memories. You're just kind of obsessed with the ones you already have because they're now finite. And so I became just very fixated on writing down all these memories, writing down all these jokes, writing down outfits, haircuts, kind of different things that I never wanted to forget. And so it didn't occur to me when I was in my 20s that, you know, even as I was becoming a sort of professional journalist, didn't occur to me that it would one day make sense as a book, but it was something that I knew I would always return to. And you know, now it is a book, which is truly strange to me, but the shape of it really took a long time to reveal itself to me.
I wonder, you write in that passage we played from the audiobook version about time and your perspective on time when you're young, how you spend hours in parking lots and then things go by so quickly. I wonder, and as an adult, I think I'll speak for myself. I experience time as a 45-year-old very differently than I did as a teenager. Yeah. I wonder, were you able to recapture some of that for better or worse in revisiting this time in your life through your writing?
You know, I really was. And I think that's the part that really made it a book and not just, you know, like hundreds of pages of me processing. I think being able to recapture, at least for myself, like a scene that you know, being able to kind of create this world that I could walk around inside, hang out inside, you know, there are these moments where it felt like I was just kind of hanging out with my other friends, not in this deeply nostalgic way, but just that I could relax in that space. It didn't feel as desperate as it did in those early months, days, years, when it felt like I just needed to kind of hoard every memory. And I think that's when it felt like a book, the fact that you could kind of be happy and joke around and remember funny, banal things. That didn't really diminish the larger tragedy that was the reason all of this was worth writing down in the first place. That's sort of when it became more of a book that could be shared rather than just kind of me venting on the page for years. I should also say that, you know, I'm a college professor now, so I'm always around people who are between the ages of 18 and 22, roughly. And I didn't realize just kind of how meaningful it was to just be around young people constantly and just kind of observe their friendships and not necessarily look for myself in them, but just being around that energy and that like perspective, it helped quite a bit too, in ways that I wasn't conscious of until much later.
The title of the book is Stay True. And at one point you mentioned how you can't actually remember how that came about, aside from that it was an inside joke between you and Ken, one of many. What do those words, stay true, mean to you today?
That's a great question. One that I should have an answer to, but it's a title that I still find a little mysterious, even though it's clearly the title of the book. Like you said, it's a joke that we had. I don't remember the origins of it. And I mean, for me, it's sort of evolved in meaning. Like, I think maybe at one point I thought staying true was adhering to a set of principles or an idea, like a fixed idea of who, you know, like one day you will be this person and you will be the finished article. I think that's very much how I viewed identity or like being a cool person or being an adult when I was younger. But now it's more just kind of staying true to possibilities, to openness, to, you know, the little twists and turns and just kind of understanding that, you know, you'll never actually be who you want to be or be who you think you are, that we're always in this process of becoming and that there's probably some deeper truth to that, at least for me, but one that I may never be able to quite wrap my head around, and that's perfectly fine.
This was, I imagine, I don't have to imagine, I know, I've read about it. It's such a searing experience for you. What's next? Do you envision another memoir? Where are you writing today?
I feel very uncomfortable writing about myself generally. So I don't envision writing another memoir. I think this was really a product of so many years of kind of trying to make sense of something, and having made sense of it, my relationship to, I guess, writing as a whole has changed. But I am working on another collection of essays called Imposter Syndrome. And it's about kind of notions of imposture and immigrant culture and teaching and learning, and sort of the ways in which we always feel as though we're these imposters waiting to be found out. But that's just sort of like a condition of life. So it's sort of a book about teaching, learning, writing. That's all I have for you at this point. The title and a vague outline.
As someone who has felt that himself, I really look forward to reading that and hope we can talk with you about that when it comes to fruition, if you can get over the imposter syndrome to make it happen.
I would love that. I would love getting over it and being back. So.
Yeah, exactly. Hua Su is the author of Stay True, a memoir. I will say it's a really, you feel weird saying great read about something that's so tragic in many ways, but it was moving and an easy read. So thank you so much for being with us to share your work today on the 21st show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Once again, the book is Stay True, a memoir. The author is Hua Su, staff writer at The New Yorker as well, and professor of English at Bard College. I want to mention, in a turn, coming up later this week, we are taking a deep dive, you might say, into deep dish in the world of Illinois pizzas. There are different variations of the pie available across the state. This Thursday, we'll start by looking at the history of the most iconic Illinois pizza, Chicago deep dish. We've also got a poll on our website where you can vote for your favorite Illinois style of pizza. And that's all the time we have for our show today. The 21st Show is produced by Aidan Choate, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Anaya Jones and Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow. Sleep on the left side.